I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 205 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us and keep this thing going, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is one of Chicago's top blues guitarists, as well as a partner in one of the area's best music venues, Dave Spector. Spector grew up on Chicago's Northwest Side, listening to music with a conscience, artists such as the Staple Singers, Bob Dylan, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. He also fell in love with the blues guitar, Buddy Guy, Magic Sam, T-Bone Walker, Albert Collins. And he was in Chicago, so he could hit the clubs and check out Guy, Otis Rush, Junior Wells, Lonnie Brooks, Sun Seals, and other legends. Spector didn't even pick up a guitar till he was almost done with high school. Yet in his 20s, he was playing a two-year stint as rhythm guitarist in Sun Seals' band. At some point, he even got up the nerve to ask Seals if he could take a solo. He shares how that went. Spector became a band leader himself in 1989 and has recorded more than a dozen albums since then. Delmark Records released his latest one, Live at Space, over the summer. Space is the intimate, musician-friendly Evanston, Illinois club that Spector helped launch in 2008 with his University of Illinois friend, Craig Golden. Spector tells the club's origin story here. He also recounts the evolution of the guitars he plays and his sound.
Now when tough times fall upon you and fill your life with doubt.
He describes how he constructs a solo and how much improvisation or composition is involved. He recalls the glory days of Chicago's blues club scene and the varying vibes at Kingston Mines, Blues, Wise Fools Pub, and other venues. He discusses how, after years of playing instrumentals with the occasional guest vocalist, he began singing. He tells of how his recently released song, The Times They Are Deranging, The Buck Stops Where, fits in with those songs of conscience he always admired.
Dark winds blow from his bloodshot stare. When the swamp becomes a cesspool, overflowing, got a gasp for air. Because the times they are deranging, people wonder the buck stops where.
And he weighs in on whether Chicago is doing enough to showcase its rich blues history for residents and visitors. I love hearing and seeing Spector play, as well as chatting with him at one of those space shows, but I'd never gone in depth with him like we do here. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Dave Spector.
Rich daddy's dollars on a silver spoon, telling lie after lie like a hot-head buffoon, like a time bomb ticking that's about to blow. Just how low can a man go?
I think I got to know you when I was writing about Space, when Space had opened up, and then got to know your music and everything else. I was actually just listening to Spectified, which was recorded in that studio at Space.
Yes, that was.
That was, it's sort of a bookend because like the new album is live at Space. So you were on stage there before you were in the studio there. So it's kind of your home turf.
Yeah. I described it to a musician last night as, you know, it was kind of like recording in my living room. So it was very comfortable, you know.
When did you do Times They Are Deranging, since that's obviously another live recording?
That was recorded actually this year. It was recorded back in February, I believe, of 2025. And I had just written it. And that was I think that was the second time the band had ever played it.
So it's kind of a rip from the headlines kind of composition.
I mean, I had been working on it for a while, just the idea, you know, that Trump and his cronies take no accountability for anything. They're always just blaming and deflecting. And, you know, I'm a huge Dylan fan. And then I thought of the song was originally called The Buck Stops Where.
Which is the subtitle. Parenthetical subtitle.
Correct, you know, referring to the famous Harry Truman quote, "The buck stops here," and I reference him in the song. So, yeah, that's one of my biggest gripes with these politicians. They're just, you know, they're cowards. They don't accept the responsibility for their mistakes ever.
Well, and like 10 years ago, you probably wouldn't have seen your music as a venue to express these thoughts, and now you do. I mean, you've only started singing relatively recently on these albums. Like, what's been the evolution there of sort of deciding what you want to say in your music?
Well, I've always, I'm kind of a child of the 60s. I was born in 63. I was raised in a very musical family. I'm the youngest. My older brother, marched in protest to the Vietnam War and almost got drafted. I was raised with, Dylan, the Staples Singers, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. My first rock concert when I was 12 was Patti Smith at the Aragon. My
Wow.
big sister took me. So
That's a good one.
I was raised, around music that has a conscience and speaks out, and great protest music always spoke to me. It was like, okay, so this music really can mean something. And I studied the civil rights movement, and so that's a big part of it. And when Trump first got elected and took power, I couldn't believe it. I just talked to somebody from Norway last week, and I asked, "Well, what do you think of what's happening here?" And he said, "Well, I travel a lot, and I travel all over Europe. And the one thing that kind of rings true that I hear all the time is how could have this happened? How could this have happened, to America?" So I was pretty disturbed by it all, and I started writing a song about him. And I was raised by a father who was a community organizer, amongst other things. I grew up in Hollywood Park on the northwest side of the city, and he was president of a umbrella community organization called the North River Commission that encompassed a lot of neighborhoods on the north side, on the northwest side. And back in the 70s, he fought Mayor Daley I to save the municipal tuberculosis sanitarium from becoming a shopping center and condo development. It is now Peterson Park, a beautiful park, nature preserve, senior citizen housing. So as a young kid, I saw my dad stand up to these big, powerful politicians and fight back. And that was an inspiration. My dad would teach me that if you ever confront a bully, don't back down. Sometimes you got to punch a bully in the nose to shut him up. And I'm a nonviolent person, but when I see somebody like Trump, not only is he a bully, but he's a huge coward. And I wrote the song "How Low Can One Man Go" about him, about his racism, his misogyny, his lies. And that was written in 2019, and I recorded it on the Blues from the Inside Out album. And back to your question about singing, or point about singing, I wasn't singing at all. I was, perfectly happy with letting my guitar be my form of musical expression. And I wrote this song, I wrote the lyrics, and I had John Katke over at my apartment thinking that he would sing it. And I just kind of started rapping the vocals to him. And he looked at me and he said, "Dave, you should sing this. You should sing this. The way you're just rapping it and talking it, it really should be your voice." So that was the first time I sang, and it was a protest song. And then on the same album, I also wrote "March Through the Darkness," which was inspired by the Staples Singers and Mavis specifically, their song "Freedom Highway" that Pops wrote
Right.
for Martin Luther King.
When you got into music initially, was some of that kind of social drive in the back of your mind, or were they really sort of two separate things in the beginning at least?
Definitely was not a factor when I got into music. I got into music just because I fell in love with blues guitar. And, I started out playing Stones and Allman Brothers, and then I discovered their roots. And then I realized, hey, wait a minute, I live in Chicago. This music is happening very close to me where I live. So I fell in love with, early Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and Magic Sam and T-Bone Walker and Albert Collins. And so the music came first. The social message kind of, and the kind of thing came much later.
And you were relatively late in picking up a guitar for the first time, right?
True. I actually played classical piano when I was a kid. My mom was a classical pianist, and her father was a Steinway dealer in Chicago. So I grew up with a Steinway in my living room in Hollywood Park. We all took piano lessons. I decided that I wanted to play basketball, so I stopped taking piano lessons and then picked up the guitar for the first time, really, when I was 17 or 18, getting ready to go to school in Champaign.
Wow. So, and what kind of guitar did you pick up? Was it acoustic, electric?
Yeah, the first guitar I picked up was my brother's classical nylon string guitar.
Oh, so much different.
Yeah, and that's kind of just what I learned basic chords on. And then I got kind of a Les Paul offshoot that I didn't really like. And I remember going to see a character in Rogers Park called Chicago Slim. He was a blues man and kind of infamous guitar dealer. He had a shop on Sheridan Road in Rogers Park. And I bought a Telecaster from him. And he had told me that he had sold guitars to Keith Richards. And, I was impressed by that.
Right. So you were already in college at that point?
Yeah, I think that was my first year in college.
And when you did you take lessons, and when you were learning guitar, were you immediately learning to sort of play notes and solo as opposed to just strum chords and stuff?
The first basic, I remember taking lessons at the Old Town School in Evanston for a short time. I think it was on Noyes Street. I just learned the basic, cowboy chords, as they're called. And I kind of taught myself how to play lead guitar and got some tips from some friends in Champaign. And then when I moved out back to Chicago, I got some tips from people like Steve Freund and Jimmy Johnson. But I really learned a lot by playing along with records.
Yeah, I was going to
Just,
ask you that. Like, what were
yeah.
the records you played along with, and were you trying to sort of recreate like the solos on those records then?
I was taught really early that the most important thing to do is really become a good rhythm guitar player first. So early on, I was really just focusing on learning chords, learning how to play along with records, and developing good time and rhythm. And I remember spending hours and hours and hours within memory of Elizabeth Reed trying to learn out the riff, trying to learn the riffs, and but I couldn't touch, the solos. Sympathy for the Devil, Keith's solo on Sympathy for the Devil was the first solo that I really tried to copy. And that's pretty basic blues. And he plays slow, he takes his time, which is something the older blues guys taught me. The best piece of advice I ever got was when they would just say, "Son, take your time, take your time." So I remember that solo and that lead playing really was important.
Yeah, there's some guitarists who are like, look how fast I can play, but those are not the ones I respond to.
I agree 100%. I respect the virtuoso element of music, especially, if you're talking about classical piano like Vladimir Horowitz or Segovia, who I saw in high school. But to me, the most important thing about music is really the feeling and the soul. And if people are playing too many notes, that whole concept kind of gets lost.
Have you been pretty strictly an electric guitar player as opposed to having a regular steel string acoustic that you'll pull out also?
Yeah, I'd say 95% electric. I have a Gibson Hummingbird. I have a couple resonator guitars that I lately have been playing a lot of open G and some slide playing on. I love country blues, acoustic blues. I love, the sound of the Stones. Their acoustic stuff is some of my favorite acoustic rock and roll. But I really don't pick up an acoustic guitar too often.
My impression also, you started with the Telecaster and kind of got into darker tones as you moved along. Like, what's your guitar evolution?
Yeah, the Telecaster phase was, just basically because Keith was my first guitar hero. But sh pretty shortly after that, when I left school in Champaign and moved back to Chicago, I started playing Strats. And I kind of liked, I didn't like the real piercing, bright tone of Fenders. So I would turn the bass and mids up on my amp and not turn the treble up too high. And I liked using heavier strings and getting kind of a darker tone.
Like the neck pickup instead of.
Exactly. Still love the neck pickup and play it, 80% of the time. And I think some of that also came about because I also was listening to people like Kenny Burrell and T-Bone Walker, And they had, you know, darker tones, and they were playing hollow body guitars, so which I also got into, you know, playing Gibson ES-175s and various Epiphone archtops. And that's definitely, you know, kind of a fuller, darker tone always appealed to me.
And then the hollow body versus the solid body, like it sounds like you've gone back and forth on that too.
Yeah, I still do. I mean, my guitar evolution continued, and then like in around 2009, I think I got my first Fender Jazzmaster. And one of the reasons is because I played Strats for years. I switched to hollow bodies, and didn't play Strats for a long time. And then when I went back to pick up my Strats, they felt really small after playing these big archtops and semi-hollow bodies. And I'm 6'4", so I got a hold of a Jazzmaster. I don't remember how or why, but I just loved it. It's a bigger guitar. It has fatter kind of P90 style pickups, so you can get a fatter tone, but it still feels like a Fender. And it has the bigger whammy bar, which I love. A Strat's whammy bar is considerably smaller. So I found with the Jazzmaster, I could get kind of a fatter Fender tone out of a bigger guitar. On my first album, Bluebird Blues, which was recorded in 1990, I played a couple songs on a 1955 ES-175, completely hollow body. And, you know, I was doing T-Bone Walker covers. We did Railroad Station Blues. So a type of guitar like that really fit that song. And I still love the tone of archtops.
But is it more that, but you prefer the tone of the solid body Jazzmaster?
I like the tone of it a lot. I don't know if I'd say I prefer it, but it's just a lot more comfortable to play.
Yeah. Now
Easier.
I've been like sort of trying to get like pay more attention to guitars and how they sound and everything. So I find this all really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I love talking guitars, and I buy and sell way too many of them.
Well, I half the time I run into you is at Guitar Works in Evanston, so you're
You know. Still a few things better than hanging out at the guitar store.
I think the last thing you were getting a new sort of bolt-in strap on your guitar so it wouldn't fly off your body
Oh
while you're playing.
yeah, I was probably having strap lock buttons installed, which I use all the time, you know, especially after that scene in The Last Waltz where Clapton, you know, loses his Strat during Further On Up the Road, and Robbie takes this killer solo.
Yeah, you don't want that to happen to you.
Right.
What was the, do you remember the first solo you ever took on stage?
Wow. The first time I was ever on stage was probably at a jam session at either Blues on Halsted with Big Time Sarah, who used to host the Monday Blues Jams, or maybe the Kingston Mines. They had the first two open mic blues jams that I went to.
And they're like practically across the street, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And then I remember, I think the first gig I ever played where I actually got paid was when Steve Freund, who was kind of my mentor and big brother in the early days, hired me to play at Blues Chicago, which is also still there. But I don't think he gave me any solos, which was totally fine. He hired me to be his rhythm guitar player. So yeah, I can't remember the first solo I took. I just remember those early open mics I went to when I was like 20, 21, I was really nervous. I knew that. I remember that.
When you were going up there those first times and playing solos, were these things that you'd kind of practiced and worked out ahead of time? Like, okay, I'm going to play this solo and it's going to sound like this, and you sort of compose it? Or is it like you're in the moment trying to play what comes to you at that point?
Totally spontaneous, because going to the blues jams, you really didn't know what was going to happen. You know, you'd get on stage
Right.
with musicians that you never played with, and you didn't know what songs they were going to play, and you just kind of had to be ready. I remember a jam I went to at the Mines with my old friend Bob Whitman, who was one of my jamming buddies, and we got up together and had worked some stuff out, but we were kind of, you know, naively surprised because, you know, we weren't going to be able to play that with a rhythm section that we had never played with. So, you know, it was kind of a good learning experience on how to prepare for an open jam. You really don't know what to expect.
What was the vibe at each of these clubs at the time? There's Blues, Kingston Mines. Did some feel more touristy? Did some feel more, genuine? Was it all just all an opportunity?
The mines always felt more touristy, but back then the blues scene was so strong. There were so many great players on the scene playing all the time, and almost all of them are gone now. And I talk about that today when people ask me about the blues scene today, and I say, well, I came up in the mid 80s when you could hear Otis Rush and Junior Wells and Lonnie Brooks and Sun Seals and Louis Myers and Dave Myers and all the great piano players. Chicago used to be a great blues piano town with Pine Top
Pinetop
Perkins,
Perkins,
Sonny
yeah.
Lam Slim, Blind John Davis, Jimmy Walker, Big Moose Walker, Detroit Jr. There were very few blues piano players left on the scene. So, what I call like the golden age of Chicago blues, the 50s and 60s, a lot of the guys from that era were still alive in the 80s, and you could hear them all the time. So it was pretty special. And the North Side blues clubs, like Blues and Wise Fools Pub and the Kingston Mines, would regularly book those great artists. So it was pretty great back then. It really, really is not even close to being the same right now.
Did you have any particular awestruck moments when you first got on stage with one of these guys?
Yeah, there were many. I remember Magic Slim was one of my heroes, Magic Slim and the Teardrops, one of the best electric blues bands that I ever saw. And they played all the time on the North Side and the South Side. Magic Slim played a jazz master, and he was taller than me. He was like 6'6". Played a jazz master through a Super Reverb. The Super Reverb still is my favorite amp of all time. And I remember he called me up. And the first time I got up on stage with Slim, his brother Nick Holt was on bass. Magic Slim was like 6'6". Nick Holt was like 6'6", and I was the short guy at 6'4". And I was playing with one of my favorite bands, one of my favorite guitar players, taking the place of John Primer, who was his rhythm guitar player. And I learned so much from watching John Primer play rhythm behind Magic Slim. So that was one awestruck moment that comes to mind. Another one is early 90s at the old Buddy Guy's Legends. I was playing there with my band. I was probably 30. And back then, Buddy would often get up and sit in with bands with his guitar. Now he still gets up at age 89 and sits in with bands, but he rarely, if ever, will play guitar. He'll sing and drink cognac and swear and tell great jokes. But so Buddy got up on stage one night with his Strat, and we started jamming. And Otis Rush was playing pool over to the right side of the stage, where there were three or four pool tables at the old Legends. And Buddy saw Otis and called him up on stage. So I got to play behind Buddy and Otis at the same time. That blew my mind and almost made me cry.
Wow. What was it about the blues in particular that just drew you in like nothing else?
The power and feeling and soul of the music. My parents listened to Midnight Special every Saturday night on WFMT. And when I was a kid, I was home and they always had music on. The Midnight Special was on. And I remember when Lead Belly or Big Bill Brunsey or even Muddy Waters, which got played on the Midnight Special once in a while, came on. After hearing Judy Collins and Peter, Paul, and Mary, I was like, oh my God, what is that? That's the shit. I mean, that just like almost gave me, it did give me goosebumps. It was so powerful. And I'd been listening to the Stones and the Beatles and the Dead and the Allman Brothers and great rock and roll, but when I heard Muddy or Big Bill, I was pretty blown away by the power and the feeling and just the serious, tough attitude of the music that just grabbed me from then on and never let go.
Did you have a moment also where you're listening to the Stones and all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, they got this from Chicago. I'm in Chicago and all these players are here and the Stones are making the pilgrimage here to do this stuff that's in my backyard.
Yep, exactly. I definitely picked up on that. I mean, I could tell, obviously, they were doing it a different way. Faster rhythms and grooves. But I really enjoyed going back to hear, you know, Howlin' Wolf doing Little Red Rooster instead of the Stones. Or hearing Chuck Berry do Little Queenie. As much as I love Get Your Yayas Out and the Stones version, you know, I think that's how so many people got into the blues, is by realizing, you know, even the Doors and the Stones and so many other bands, the Animals, right, were covering Chicago blues and R&B.
Do you feel like your style early on was modeled on anyone in particular? And was there a point where you feel like you sort of pushed away from that and found your own voice?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think a lot of musicians in blues and jazz and rock and roll copy other players early on. Well, sometimes their whole careers they copy. You know, I tried to copy Magic Sam. He was a big early influence. I couldn't really touch what he was doing. But Steve Freund was really a big influence, gave me a lot of guidance and casual lessons and hired me on gigs. And I was copying him for a long time and sounding too much like him. And it was kind of embarrassing. But he was such a great player. It took me a while. You know, I think the key is you got to just stop listening to your early influences and find your own way. And that's kind of what I did. You know, I was a hardcore blues purist for a long time. And then I started listening to like Blue Note and Prestige jazz records. I got into Horace Silver and Dexter Gordon and Lee Morgan, and I loved it. I still do. And I think that was good for me because it gave me a little more of a jazz sensibility, but it also got me away from listening to a lot of the blues that I was trying to copy, and kind of helped me develop a style that incorporated a jazz sensibility with a blues feeling that I think helped shape my music.
Yeah, a lot of those jazz records, you know, especially the ones with lead guitar on them, they definitely have their sort of blues excursions in there. Like there's a lot of overlap in the jazz and the blues worlds, and certainly in Chicago as well. So yeah, I was curious about how much of that overlap had happened with you.
Yeah, no, I love jazz that has, you know, the blues roots in it. And, you know, there was the genre that they called hard bop or soul jazz, you know, jazz that combined blues and gospel and jazz. And that music really speaks to me.
How did you end up with Sun Seals? You toured with him for what, like 2 years?
Yeah, that was my first big break to play with a touring big name blues artist. I had been playing some of my first early gigs were with Sam Lay and Hubert Sumlin. Jimmy Johnson used to hire me when Jimmy was playing piano. He hired me to play guitar with him. I got a gig with a legendary blues band for a short time. Willie Big Eye Smith and Calvin Fuzz Jones, who were Muddy Waters' rhythm section, had that band. And a friend of mine named Brad Weeks was playing rhythm guitar with Sun Seals and told me, hey, Dave, I got to leave Sun. I don't know if you'd be interested, but he's looking for a rhythm guitar player. And I was like, hell yes, I'm interested. What do I do? He goes, well, let me set up a meeting. And he set up a meeting at Blue Chicago just to go and sit in and audition. And I did. And Sun hired me. And, you know, Sun was playing the Chicago circuit, all the North Side clubs from Blues Etc. to the Mines to Wise Fools to Blues on Halsted. But he was also touring mostly on the East Coast. So I got to do a lot of gigs in New York City with him, a lot of tours in New England. Those gigs in New York City, I mean, I was 24, 25, 26, and we were playing the Lone Star and the Village Gate and Tramps. We even played a concert in Central Park. Those were some of the best gigs of my life.
And what was it like being the rhythm guitarist for all of those?
I was totally fine with it because I loved rhythm guitar. I loved people like Steve Cropper and even, more obscure Chicago guys like Luther Tucker, who played rhythm guitar for Otis Rush. A lot of the Chess recordings by people like Little Walter, which had Robert Junior Lockwood and Lewis Myers and Luther Tucker on guitar. They rarely took solos. They were just playing rhythm, but they were playing very creative and inventive rhythm. So I loved it. I did get to a point though where I wasn't getting any solos, and I finally got the nerve to talk to Sun. And Sun was a pretty tough, intimidating dude. I mean, he was very nice, but his nickname was the Bad Axe. He was a bad dude, and I was, a little intimidated, this young kid in his mid-20s. But I said, "Son, is there? I mean, I struggle to get the words out. Is there any way I could maybe get like one solo a night, maybe on a slow blues?" And he just laughed and he goes, "Hell yeah, you're gonna do that." So we would open the band would open the show without him. We would do two or three numbers, and I'd get to solo on those tunes. But when Sun was up, the first year, I didn't solo at all. And I was cool. I mean, towards the end, I got a little frustrated that I wasn't getting any solos, and that's why I asked him. But I still really enjoy playing rhythm guitar.
So after that, did you have like a big solo every night?
I would say maybe a two chorus slow blues solo. Yeah, and it was nice. It was. I mean, that's that that that. I started to realize, hey man, I can really express myself more on a solo than playing rhythm. And
Right.
that's one of the reasons I left the band, is because I had something to say. I had a style that I was kind of developing very early on, and it involved playing lead guitar, and I wasn't able to do that with Sun.
What did you learn as a soon to be band leader from watching Sun Seals as a band leader all that time and being on stage with them?
Well, he was a very, very serious guy on stage, and very serious as a band leader, and didn't take any shit from anybody, including club owners, and just had this very almost kind of like stoic presence, which I kind of picked up on. There are many other blues artists, and still are, that are much more the entertainer, that have the shtick.
Right.
Sun didn't have that at all, and I was glad, because I don't really, I mean, I like seeing that shtick a little bit, but sometimes it's all you see for every song, and that doesn't really appeal to me. So, kind of just like the all business, this music is serious, take it seriously, play it seriously. And I might have gone a little too far with that, because I was a pretty tough band leader when I first started out. I wanted my guys to show up an hour before showtime, and not show up drunk or stoned. And I had
Seems
some issue.
reasonable.
Yeah, I had some issues with some of my early singers that were big partiers. Hey man, let's party. Blues is nothing but a party. I never really saw it that way. Music can bring enjoyment. It can be fun when it's good, but I took it really seriously, and Sun was a big influence on that.
Do you remember the first song you ever wrote?
The first song I ever wrote, yeah. The first song I ever wrote was called Wind Chill, and it's an instrumental on my first album, Bluebird Blues. And that was inspired by kind of the Kenny Burrell, Jimmy Smith sound that I had grown to love. And I still get requests for it. And I remember Jonathan Brandmeier used it as music for his weather forecast on the
Huh.
on his morning radio shows, Wind Chill.
That's why you're rich.
Hey man. Hey, wait, here comes some more mail money.
So do you, how did you write that song? Is that something where you sat with your guitar and just kind of composed it and then taught it to the band? Is that generally how it works?
Yeah, I wrote it with a horn player named Des Ormeaux, a tenor player who's still on the Chicago scene, mostly on the jazz scene. And back when I first started my band in 89, a lot of those gigs I would have would be guitar, bass, drums, vocals, and sax. So we kind of wrote the melody, the head, so to speak, the theme of the song together, guitar and sax. And you can hear that on the recording. It's a slightly different chord progression during the head. The solos are over 12 bar blues, and it's got that kind of guitar sax theme playing together and playing harmonies together that's real common in jazz.
And again, do you write the solo at the time, or is that after you get it on its feet and you got there, so you're sort of spacing there, like, all right, here's the spot for the solo, and now I'm going to figure that out?
Yeah, no, I've never written a solo in my life. That's almost always improvised. And sometimes when I first improvise it and come up with ideas, I'll stick with some of those ideas. I'll remember them and I'll be like, hey, that idea worked over the four chord, or that idea worked over the one chord. But I've never written out a solo in advance on anything.
How has the soloing evolved over the years?
Good question. I often use the analogy with music, especially when I teach. I'll tell my students, you know, playing this music is like speaking a language, and you're going to learn some words, and then you're going to learn some phrases, and then you're going to learn some sentences so you can speak with your playing. First, a note is a word, maybe. Then you put like four notes together, you have a phrase, like you're talking. And then you put 20 notes together and you have a sentence. And I say to my students, you know, when you speak to someone, like we're speaking, you hopefully want to speak clearly so people can understand you. And I kind of look at music like that. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I love music that has space and time and good phrasing is because you can really understand it. If it's just like a total mess of notes, you know, just thrown together at high speed, to me, it's really hard to understand that. And that doesn't resonate with me. So, you know, I like phrasing that is kind of clear and to the point and played, most importantly, with soul and feeling. So over the years, I've developed this language. I've developed, you know, as musicians call them, these chops that, you know, come from 40 years of playing. And I put my solos together spontaneously, hopefully most of the time, through these notes, through these notes, these phrases, these sentences of music, these paragraphs of music that hopefully, you know, come together as a good solo. So I try not to think about it too much when I'm playing, but I'm kind of drawing from my musical vocabulary right. that I've learned over four decades.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of listeners who, and this probably applies more to jazz than to blues, but I think it applies to almost anything with a solo, where I think some people are intimidated by listening to it because they're like, well, I don't know if I get it. I don't know if I get like what exactly distinguishes, you know, that this one is better than that one, or, you know, and not that anything has to be better than anything else, but what you're saying about the phrasing and having people be able to basically follow it and speaking clearly is different from something where it's like sort of a blur and there's nothing, it's not a qualitative difference, like one's better than the other, but it's interesting to think of it that way in terms of the communication aspect of, you know, you're speaking through the guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I like listening to Coltrane, and I like listening to some free jazz where there really is that freedom, and I love it. I can't always listen to it for a long period of time, but you know, I also think one of the keys for me in any kind of music, with any instrument that is so important is tone. You know, having a tone that just that just sounds good and feels good, that's rich and warm. It can be biting and shrill as well, you know, thinking about Albert Collins, for example, or, you know, some of Miles Davis, some of Coltrane. It can be, you know, it can be upsetting and provocative, and that's okay. But I love hearing guitar players, especially with good tone. Guitar players with shitty tone suck. Sorry.
I mean, are you someone who has like 50,000 effects pedals or really not much at all?
No. I didn't use effects for a long time, and I kind of regret ever starting using effects because it's a slippery slope and there's so many options. I mean, it's space where I'm there all the time and I see pedal boards that, like, you know, are like 4 feet by 6 feet, sometimes just outrageously large. And I just think to myself, I would trip on that and fall if I had that under me on stage. No, I use usually just one boost pedal that has a slight amount of overdrive that David Hidalgo from Los Lobos turned me on to. It's called the Sparkle Drive. I use that a lot. I have a little wah-wah pedal that I use maybe once or twice a night. I have a Hammond organ Leslie simulator that I used to use more often. Now I really don't use it at all, but it's still, I have a pedal board that's maybe a foot wide and, you know, maybe a half a foot deep, just with four pedals. My main pedal is the tuner.
Yeah, I love that Leslie sound on, you know, it's like sort of a Beatles Stones thing, but you wouldn't want to hear it on every song, but it is a cool effect.
Yeah, I did on Spectify, the record you mentioned earlier. There's one tune I do in an organ trio setting where I use this great pedal that Hughes and Kettner made called the Rotosphere. And it's a great Leslie effect sound. It actually has a tube in it. And I recorded it with Pete Benson, who's a great organ player, and Greg Weiserpret, who now lives in San Francisco. But I got that organ sound with an organ player, so it's almost like two organ sounds at once. Jimmy Vaughn was a big influence on me, and he got some great Hammond Leslie type sounds with the early T-Birds. There's a great song on the I think it's the album Butt Rock, and it's called One's Too Many and 100 Ain't Enough. He gets a great Leslie sound on that.
I was talking to a friend of mine who's actually played guitar at Space. We're just talking about guitars, and again, I'm trying to figure this stuff out at my advanced age. And I was asking him about a certain guitar if he was interested, and he's like, no, he's like, I'm really not a Fender guy. You know, he plays an SG, and he's like, you got to find your own sound. And it was such a basic thing to say, but it really had me thinking. And I've been noticing when I go to concerts that I go to one concert, like I saw Dave Alvin playing with Third Mind. And I think he played the same guitar the entire time. I think everyone on that stage played basically the same instrument for the whole show. Mm-hmm. And then I'll see another show, and this is maybe the majority, where every song you're changing guitar, and you're like, here comes the Gibson, here's the Fender, here's the Strat, here's the Tele. And I've just been thinking about that sort of that notion of, and, you know, like, look, the Beatles had like a gazillion sounds, and then, you know, the Stones, you hear that Keith Richards Tele. This sounds like you're on the, you know, find your own sound. You got the jazz master, you got the tone, and you know what your voice is.
Yeah, I think that's really the key. But I also think, and the greatest compliment that I get is when I'm playing, you know, an Epiphone Riviera with Mini Humbuckers, if I'm playing the jazz master, or if I'm playing a Strat, or if I'm playing a Jazzmaster with different pickups, I have a few with different pickups, or if I'm playing, you know, a Gibson semi-hollow body, the greatest compliment I get is when somebody says, Dave, you know, whatever you're playing, it sounds like you.
Right.
So I think that's what happens eventually. You know, I have a funny story about Space and guitars. We had Lucinda Williams for the first time back maybe 10 years ago, and it was just a duo. And it was Lucinda Williams and Doug Pettibone, great guitar player who I think lives in Nashville. And I'm not exaggerating. Doug showed up with, I think, 13 or 14 guitars on stage for one set. And, you know, I was wowed by it. I was like, oh, my God, this is so cool. And he played most of them, but it was a bit overkill. You know, Lucinda's just playing her acoustic. And the next night we had Albert Lee one guitar.
Right. Well, and a lot of these guys, they'll have like someone tuning it after you'll play one song and then it goes off and the roadie's tuning it and then giving him a different one that's just been tuned.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to that, especially if I had a guitar tech off to the side of the stage that could, like they do to the rock stars, they carry him on stage and put the strap on the player.
There you go.
I'd like to experience that someday. I don't know if I will, but yeah,
Oh.
the most guitars I've ever brought out to a gig, I think is four, but for me, it's usually just two, sometimes just one.
So, and Craig Golden, you guys went to college together? I'm getting into sort of the origin story of space now.
Yeah, we did. I mean, Craig's, I think, 5 or 6 years older than me. And the story is that my big sister Susie was going to school in Champaign. I think I was maybe first year in high school. She's Craig's age. And I went down to visit her, and she didn't know what to do with me. All I wanted to do was play basketball and listen to music. And she goes, "Hey, let me introduce you to my friends, Craig and Lonnie. They're brothers. And they both play basketball and they both play guitar." And that's how I met Craig and Lonnie in Champaign. And I remember the first time I met Craig, I think he was sitting on the quad with his legs crossed, just playing acoustic guitar. But he left. I don't know if he graduated or transferred, but again, he was older than me. So I didn't get to know Craig that well, but I became really close with Lonnie, who was an economics teaching assistant in Champaign. And we hung out a lot, and then when I came back to Chicago, I got to know Craig better because he had bought his first building. He was just getting into real estate back then and bought a building in Roscoe Village, and he rented me a loft space in that building, not far from the Beat Kitchen. Robbie Fulks also lived there. John Spiegel lived there.
Nice.
There was a rehearsal space. Yeah, the apartment was next to the loft space, and that's where I lived. So there was always music going on, and that's how I met Craig.
And how did you become involved in the creation of space?
In about, I don't know, 2005 or so, I started going out. I've always lived in the city, but I started hanging out in Evanston with Craig and some of his buddies, who would hang out at either Pete Miller's or Bar Louie. I don't remember what it was called before it was Bar Louie, but it was just like a Thursday night, guys' night out, having beers and hanging out. And Stuart Rosenberg was
Right.
one of that group. There was a lot of talk about opening a music venue in Evanston, and I became involved in that. But I'm just remembering to backtrack. Before that, Craig was looking for a music club. His real estate company had done really well, and he started to think, maybe I should open up a music club. And I introduced him to a fellow named Jay, who was the general manager at Buddy Guy's, and Jay knew the guy who was selling the Subterranean in Wicker Park. And I talked to Craig about it, and he was like, maybe I should buy that. Maybe you want to be involved. And I remember we met with the owner of the Subterranean, and we're talking about buying it. It never panned out. So we were talking about, he had told me, "Hey, I'd really love to open a music venue someday." And I kind of said, "Hey, I'd love to be able to help curate that somehow." And that's kind of what I do at Space. So between that and then the discussions with Stuart and Craig, who eventually bought the building where Space is now in 2006, 2007, because we opened in 2008. That's so kind of how it all kind of came to be.
Were you the one giving it those really musician-friendly touches, like the huge, comfortable green room and all that sort of thing, or was that all of you together being like, this just should be the place that musicians actually want to hang out?
That I have to give most of the credit, if not all of it, to Craig there. I mean, he's, being with his real estate background and his design background, and his great taste in furniture. He pretty much, he and the architect designed that. I brought a really nice amp collection into the studio and guitar collection, and kind of befriended a lot of musicians and kind of made them feel welcome. They knew musicians were helping to run the place, and I kind of, knew how to talk to them, and was kind of a conduit between the club world and the musical world. I think I still am.
Did you think the studio was going to take off as a recording studio as well?
We did. We did. And unfortunately, it didn't for a number of reasons. But it was just a little too crazy to have this club with 300 shows with bands loading in sometimes as early as 2 or 3 o'clock to be able to book sessions, right next door. I mean, it was pretty soundproof, not 100% soundproof. I mean, there were nights where we were doing acoustic sessions in the studio while shows were going on, but that was pretty tricky because you could hear bleed sometimes. And, you know, Stuart was kind of the guy that we thought was really going to help the studio take off, and didn't quite work out.
Yeah, for those of you listeners who have not been to Space, which if you're ever in Chicago, Evanston, you definitely should go because they have a pretty awesome show almost every night. So Space recently expanded and you have a whole new lobby and patio and everything. You would walk in and there's a restaurant in front called Union, which actually has terrific pizza and Italian food and some other stuff. And then you walk along, walk toward the back, and there's Space, which is a room for 200, 250 people. And then it was the studio, and then in the back was the green room. And at some point, sort of during the pandemic, and you guys, the bar used to be kind of in that rectangular room and would cause sort of this bottleneck when you walked in, and they basically busted out one of the rooms of the studio, and now that's where the bar is, and the flow of the place is much better, but you don't have the studio anymore.
Yeah, the dream was to have the restaurant going, the club going, the studio going, like all at the same time. And we succeeded with 2 out of 3, so not bad.
And you did record Spectified there, so you have, you know, yeah. And there are other things that are recorded there too, so you have a record of that at least.
Yeah, we've done some cool sessions there. I mean, I remember Kurt Elling recorded there, and, you know, we had Jim Reeves, who is this legendary New York recording engineer who worked for Columbia Records, who, you know, mixed Lou Reed and Edgar Winter and B.B. King and ZZ Top, and would tell stories about John Lennon kind of calling him into Studio B while he was recording in Studio A. And John would say, "Hey, Jim, tell me what you think of this." Jim moved back to Evanston, had his own studio there. We hired him as a recording engineer. So he would engineer a lot of the early few and far between sessions we do in the studio there, including Spectified. But, you know, I still have people ask me, you know, are you still doing sessions there? We still have the tracking room and everything's still wired if we ever wanted to do sessions. But where the control room was, that is now our new bar.
Right. Well, and you were able to record your new album live at Space, but on the stage of Space instead of in a studio. So
Yeah. We've always been able to do really nice live recordings from the stage, 2-track or multi-track. And for the Live at Space record, our system was acting up a little and wasn't 100% reliable at the time. And I brought in a great engineer named Freddie Breitberg, who had worked for Curtis Mayfield at Kurtom, did a ton of sessions at Alligator. I hired Freddie to come in and bring in his own mics and record the set for my Live at Space album. And that worked out just beautifully. You did a great job.
And, yeah, sounds great.
Yeah, one of the things I'm most proud of is that album was recorded one set, one night, you know.
It was not pieced together from a whole bunch of performances. It's,
exactly.
That's the show you're at.
Yeah. So it really is live.
Tell me about when you started your Blues from the Inside Out podcast.
I can't remember the exact year, but how it developed was I was the label that put out Spectified is the one label that I recorded for other than Delmark in my whole career. In 2010, a label called Fret 12, which is mostly a rock guitar label, with at one time they were doing a lot of video content, including DVDs called The Sound and the Story, where they would have people like Leslie West, and they would film their Sound and the Stories often at Space, and they would film him live on stage, and then they would film him telling his life story and sometimes giving guitar lessons. So Fret 12 was doing that. They signed me to be their first blues artist. And then they said, Dave, how would you feel about doing some video content for us and recording interviews with blues artists and just artists that come through space? And I started doing a series, it was called Fret 12 Blues and Beyond video interviews. And this was right around the time Spectified came out in 2010. I remember going to interview Warren Haynes at the House of Blues when he played there, but I interviewed a lot of the great Chicago blues people, Eddie Clearwater, Jimmy Johnson, many others. And I would also interview people that would play at Space, Shamika Copeland, Duke Robillard. I remember a great interview that I did with the great jazz organ player Lonnie Smith. He was wearing his turban. He was such a cool trip.
Nice.
So I did, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 interviews for Fret 12, John Hammond, Hubert Sumlin, some great artists. And I loved, it was just like we're talking, just musician to musician, just talking to people, asking them questions that maybe a typical journalist wouldn't ask. And people were relating to it. And podcasts were starting to become really popular. And I remember some of my friends were saying, hey, Dave, you should take that and turn it into a podcast. And we had the studio at Space at the time, so I would record my podcast interviews, many of them. I think I have about 35 online. If you want to check them out, bluesfromtheinsideout.com, I think, is where you can find them, or just go to my website. So we would record them in this really great recording studio at Space, so they sound really good. And we'd often do some video sometimes. I remember when I interviewed Sam Lane and Corky Siegel, I interviewed them in the studio and then we jammed together. Also did that with Donald Kinsey from the Kinsey Report, who played with Bob Marley and Peter Tosh. So it went really well and I really enjoyed it. But then when we tore the studio down and COVID hit, I was doing some interviews like this via YouTube, but not having the studio kind of made it a little more difficult to continue the podcast for me.
Yeah, in terms of just like having musicians in a room together.
Yeah, the access. I mean, I still could do it, and I still might, restart it.
Nice. A few years ago, I went to Nashville and Memphis for the first time. And, there's a lot about the music in those cities you can go to. I mean, the country stuff in Nashville, but also this African American Music Museum is really interactive, and going to Stax in Memphis and Sun Studios. Do you feel like Chicago does enough to sort of show off its amazing blues history? I just feel like there should be somewhere. I mean, there's Chess Studios, but in terms of like the destination places people travel to experience and learn about Chicago blues, is Chicago doing enough?
No, exclamation point. No, it's a shame. I don't want to use the word criminal, but hey, we're in Chicago. It's criminal.
It's redundant, criminal in Chicago.
I mean, and I go to Navy Pier once in a while, the biggest tourist attraction in Illinois, in Chicago, and they're playing country music. Like, what the fuck? You're in
Yeah,
Chicago. Playing
really.
country music? Come on, put on some Curtis Mayfield and Muddy Waters and Jerry Butler and Howlin' Wolf. No, it's a shame. It's a shame. It's there's been talk and fundraising efforts to open a Chicago Blues Museum, which would be wonderful. I mean, if I were to do it, I would do a Chicago Music Museum and incorporate soul and jazz and R&B
House.
and house and hip hop, and the musical history and culture in this city is so rich. And it's really a shame that there is so little. I mean, yeah, Chess has a nice, you can still go to the Chess Record Studio slash museum and get tours, and it's fascinating and cool. But that's just a really small part of what the city's music is all about. So yeah, it's sad.
Wow. Yeah, no, I agree. I've just been thinking about that and going, it's like you don't have, I mean, Chicago's always looking for, I mean, people come visit Chicago all the time, but you make your pilgrimage to the blues clubs. But Yeah, there just needs to be more, there need to be more places, or at least a place where you can really immerse yourself in it. I want to ask you about one more of your talents, which is photography.
All right.
So you go on your website, you could buy concert, on stage photos you've taken, and also a lot of shots of bald eagles. So tell me about your evolution as a photographer.
I took photography in high school, and I learned how to use a darkroom and develop film when I was a teenager. My father and my brother, also hobbyist photographers. I have some of my dad's photos hanging up in my apartment. I remember taking my Olympus OM-1 to a Grateful Dead concert at the Uptown in maybe 79, and got some shots from like the fifth row of Jerry and Bob and Phil. And it was just totally for fun, just because I love the art of photography and capturing the moment, so to speak. I kind of lost interest in it. Always had maybe a point and shoot camera, and then got much more into it with my iPhone, as many people use their cameras on their phones for photography. And I was shooting a lot at space, and my photos were looking okay, but if I ever wanted to like zoom in on an artist, the quality was pretty shitty. So I decided to go out and buy a real camera, and this was 4 years ago. So I bought a Nikon and started shooting a lot of live shows.
Like a single lens reflex.
I actually bought one of the new mirrorless cameras, like the next step from the digital SLR, the digital single lens. So a camera, the latest technology is the cameras that don't have mirrors, so they're a little faster, and qualities some people would argue slightly better, maybe not. But I bought a mirrorless Nikon and started shooting shows, and the quality of the photos was so much better than my phone, obviously. And then, I live on the lakefront in Chicago, and was walking around a local bird sanctuary just east of Wrigley Field, and had my camera out just for fun. And a woman on the little path there near the bird sanctuary said, "Did you see them? Did you see them?" And I was like, "Did I see what?" And she go, "There's a pair of these beautiful owls just right around the corner." And I saw owls for the first time in the wild, and I was blown away by the beauty of seeing an owl. So I
Right in
started,
Chicago.
right in my own backyard. And not, I'm reminded of Larry David, where he talks about growing up in Brooklyn. Not a lot of nature, So I grew up in Chicago, and there was a little nature, but my mom sometimes had fake plants, and but anyway, I saw owls, and then somehow I started going on these nature photography Facebook pages, and I started seeing bald eagles, and I'd never seen a bald eagle in the wild. And I found out there were some out on the DuPage River near Joliet, and I found out where a nest was, and then I started upping my camera gear and buying these telephoto lenses, and photographing bald eagles. That just I fell in love with seeing them. Just so beautiful and regal and powerful, seeing them fly. That's how I got into that. And I just started shooting a ton of live shows, not only at Space. I shot the Stones at Soldier Field. I shot Paul Weller at the Vic, a lot of other venues. And I've become friends over the years with a lot of great concert photographers: Nunu, Harvey Tillis, Paul Natkin, Mark Bo Kempner,
Right.
many others. And they would give me tips and kind of learn from them.
Are you
And
getting photo passes at these concerts now, or are you just shooting from the audience?
occasionally, I have a couple small, like almost pocket-sized telephoto cameras that I can just sneak into a show without a photo pass. I'm 6'4", so being in the photo pit, it's hard to be hard to be discreet and not get in somebody's way. So I'm kind of conscious of that.
Well, and everyone's shooting every show now with their phone, so you stand out less if you have a good spot and you just got a good camera.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's such a huge difference. I mean, some phones can take okay pictures, but there's nothing like real cameras.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, Great talking in this context to you, Dave, and I always enjoy talking to you at Space and then running into it. Guitar Works in Space are the two places I usually see you, and that and Cubs Victory Parade, but that's been a while.
So yeah.
That's it for episode 205 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Dave Spector for taking us back to the glory days of Chicago blues and energizing the tradition through his dedication and great playing. His latest album, Live at Space, captures a single incendiary performance at the Chicago area club he helped found. You can buy it on vinyl or CD at delmark.com, as well as davespector.com, where signed copies of that CD and other albums are available. And go to YouTube, Apple Music, or Spotify to check out Spector's most recent single, The Times They Are Derangin'. The Buck Stops Where? Spector and his band are playing December 20th at Space. Go to evansonspace.com for tickets. You can follow Spector on Instagram as well. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swaite, who has worked with his share of Wise Fools. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.